Sisters, it's really a privilege to introduce Brother Ignatius Perkins. Brother obviously is a Dominican, not just someone like Sister Mary Joseph that we put OP on after her name. And he is serving now as Dean and Professor of Nursing and Director of the RN to BSN program at Aquinas College. That's our college in Nashville. We are so grateful to have Brother. He is a wonderful teacher, guide. I was telling a couple of you, I may have told all of you, I don't know, but you can ask Brother a question, and he will immediately give you a succinct, clear, honest, correct answer to your questions. So if you have any questions related to healthcare, I would advise you to kind of have those questions ready for him. Brother has two master's degrees, one in nursing from the College of Catholic University of America and another in education from Spalding University. In 1987, he was awarded the doctoral degree in nursing from the Catholic University of America. He also has all kinds of other stuff after his name, but I'm not going to go into all of that because we're a bit late, and I want you to have all your time for Brother, and it's a privilege to introduce our brother, Ignatius.
Good evening, sisters. Like any good educator, I have homework for you. Not really, but anyway, we'll work on these. I understand. I did send the document, the presentation to Sister Gabriella, and I don't know whether some of you have it or not. Some of you may have received it, but if you haven't received it, just let me know, and we'll get you a copy of it. I will also say that you're probably going to leave here with more questions than you had started with, and that's perfectly fine because of the complexity about what we're talking about here. I will leave a stack of my calling cards here on the table. Obviously, it says Aquinas College, and that my email address is there also. So don't hesitate to email me if you have a question. I would want to assure you that while the issues become more complex in healthcare every minute, there's lots of resources that can help you understand how we assimilate and examine these questions, so you can be faithful to your charism in your congregations, and the moral teaching of the church as well. So all those are titrated together, but there are enormous pressures coming from all sorts of places in our global world that really threaten and destabilize what we think is a normal, ordinary response, if there is such, to these issues before us. So I'm not going to read the document completely because I really want to spend more time in engaging with you on questions that you may have about ethical issues, but I will also then give you a template about how to process some of these questions, so you're not totally out in the dark, and there is a method in which you can arrive at conclusions and guidelines, suggestions about how we make decisions for ourselves, for our community, and for those in our ministry. As Mother Anne Marie said, I appreciate your introduction, Mother. I come to you with 50 years of experience of Dominican life, and now 47 of those in the Healing Ministry of Nursing. So last February, I was 50 years old in the order. So while the Healing Ministry has endowed my life in significant ways, the gifts I have received from the thousands of patients entrusted to my care far exceed by any human calculation that what I may have given to them in these healing encounters. When I leave you your presence this evening, I assure you that I will have received more than I have given to you. I will have the rich opportunity to have learned from each of you, to learn of your concerns, even struggles, in ministering to the sick and the dying of your communities, and to understand your uncertainties about the morality of new and emerging treatment decisions at the end of life. I'm eager to discuss with you some of your questions and your growing concerns of ethical issues in healthcare, and especially at the end of life. I may then come to appreciate your own experiences in your healing ministry, especially as this ministry touches some of the difficult issues which you have or will eventually face among those entrusted to your care. To set the context for the discussion, I recall the readings of John's Gospel on the Good Shepherd. My hope at the conclusion of our brief time together is to celebrate you as and your treasured vocation as faithful stewards of the lives of your sisters. I will review shortly your presence among the sick and the dying, gathering together the lost, the least, and the last of the flock, leading them through the difficult health issues and complex ethical decisions, which is your sacred gift to them. It is the beginning of your journey of hope. As we read in the Gospel of John, you have been called to be the gatekeepers of healing and hope. My conversation with you will focus on the healing ministry to which we have been called, protecting human dignity and caring for one another. I believe are both critical and much needed actions in our world today, two of the moral obligations we ought to embrace as part of our membership in the human community of believers, regardless of one's particular faith or religious persuasion. I would like to briefly talk about the general moral principles which govern our care and treatment decisions, especially at the end of life, and then conclude with an interaction with you about those ethical issues and dilemmas which are important concerns for you. My desire at the conclusion of our conversation is to leave you with a greater understanding of the privilege to engage in the healing ministry, the ministry of Jesus himself. Within this ministry, we are afforded the grace-filled moment to share the gospel of life with the sick and the dying. In this way, the healing ministry is a treasured opportunity to continue to preach to one another. One of the distinctive aspects of Jesus' ministry was the manner in which he took the common and not so common events of human life and revealed that most, if not all, of his contemporaries had not discovered that human love is revelatory of divine love, that death can disclose the possibility of new life. The challenge facing our communities today is to do the same with contemporary experiences, whether of joy or sorrow, to discover the deeper meaning that might otherwise be remained hidden. That quote is from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. As religious, our caring for one another is indispensable from our call to preach and to serve the church. We are servants for God and for our brothers and sisters. At special times in our lives, this call to serve is at the bedside of the terminally ill and dying. Here, the ministry of health care given to a dying sister or brother at one of the most vulnerable moments in their lives is truly sacred work. Such experiences occur on holy ground. With compassion and caring, we minister as Jesus did to the dying in preparation for the final union with God. As the Christian community, we have been called to preach to one another and to heal. Our ministry of healing transcends our families and our friends, however. The ministry shared with other Christian communities throughout the world calls each of us to reach beyond ourselves and to touch our brothers and sisters in our communities, those of our families and many in our apostolates, the sick, the dying, and those made vulnerable by the circumstances of their lives, the disenfranchised, the unloved, and the unwanted, and all those suffering from stigmatized illnesses. As Jesus did in his own time, each of us is called to help to bring healing and wholeness, particularly to the vulnerable people in our world, to those who are in the dawn of life, the unborn, our infants and children, those who are in the twilight of life, our aged and the dying, those who remain in the shadow of life, the disabled and people of color, those who are alienated, unwanted, and homeless, and those who are unloved and have lost all hope. For healing at the end of life to occur, even in the midst of the difficult treatment decisions we'll all be faced with, it is important that we have an understanding of the primary moral principles, ethical principles, which the Church has given us when making decisions about end-of-life care. The Church has an enormously rich framework in which to look at these questions and to arrive at decisions all within the context of the Catholic moral tradition. These principles are: human life is the foundation for all human goods. It has a special value and significance. Life is the first right of the human person and the condition of all others. Life has inherent dignity and worth and is a precious gift from God. We are not the owners of our lives and hence do not have absolute power over it. Suffering is a fact of human life and has special significance for the Christian as an opportunity to share in Christ's redemptive suffering. We have a duty to preserve our life and use it for the glory of God, but this duty is not absolute. In the face of death for many, a time when hope seems lost, the church witnesses to her belief that God alone creates each person for eternal life. Because human life is a great good, a presumption exists that human life should be prolonged. However, this presumption ceases if the means to prolong life are ineffective or involve a grave burden for a particular person. No list of human actions or medical procedures can be determined as extraordinary or extraordinary from an specific ethical perspective. A general description of the means that are usually available often prolong life or seldom involve a grave burden is possible, but specific ethical judgments require consideration of all the circumstances. When determining the moral obligation of whether to prolong life, we must know the patient's diagnosis and prognosis, as well as the circumstances or persons, places, and times and cultures. Only then may one determine what is morally obligatory and what is morally optional. If possible, every person should be allowed to make decisions for himself or herself. If the person is clearly not competent, however, a surrogate decision maker is needed. The surrogate decision maker or proxy determines what is beneficial for the patient based on what the patient would have wanted, taking into consideration all the circumstances that a reasonable person would have considered, including the burdens on the family. And finally, the decision to choose a good which entails discontinuing the use of life support may hasten death, but death is the indirect result and occurs because one chooses another legitimate good. And I'm sure that many of you are familiar with ethical religious directives, and so I'll not go into those detail at this point. They will come out in our conversation in a few minutes. In applying the moral principles in discerning a decision to forego or withdraw treatment, for example, the ultimate end of this discernment is not limited to a selection of an appropriate moral action. Rather, these decisions, as difficult as they will be at times, should enable and empower us to preserve and protect the dignity of the human person, to bring healing and hope to the dying, and to help this person to reach the spiritual goal of life to which we have all been called as members of the Christian community. Like Jesus himself, he cured the sick in his own time. We too, as members of the Christian community, bring healing to the sick and dying in our time. The blind, the lepers, the lame were drawn to Jesus the healer. So too, the dying among us in our hospitals and special care facilities, in our families and parishes, will be drawn to each of us. As ministers of healing, we are the living endowment of Jesus' own ministry of healing. For many of the sick, the dying, and the abandoned, we are their very best hope. We may well be their only hope as they attain the ultimate good of life, spiritual union with a loving Father. Every time we encounter the sick person, each time we enter the room, the home, or the space of the sick, our love for the sick and dying is implicit. As members of the Christian community, we carry to the lives of the sick the traditions of the healing ministry, which has its roots in the healing ministry of Jesus created 2,000 years ago. The dying among us, these special persons need to be with them to care for them and pray with them. Their lives, their dreams, their suffering, and their pain need the grace of our caring, the wisdom of our ideas, the values in our hearts, and the virtues of our character. These are our people. They are our patients, family members, religious members of religious communities, our parents, families, friends, colleagues, and neighbors. They are the Christian community in search of healing and hope. I've given this presentation different forms before, but this is a new addition. I think we need to take special care of our superiors. Today, sisters and brothers in ministering and leadership positions are among the most vulnerable in our communities for developing physical and psychological exhaustion. Causes for exhaustion include, for example, dealing constantly with others' expectations, oftentimes not knowing if the work is having any effect, repetition and lack of closure on issues, working with the same people over a number of years, the emotional drain on the superior, and the need for some to be frequently affirmed, managing conflict in communities and in the apostolate, constantly reaffirming the common good versus the individual preferences in living situations and ministries, placing unreasonable expectations in the self and on others, failure to exercise a healthy balance between prayer and community life, ministry and leisure, and loneliness in carrying the burdens of responsibility for the community. Making decisions about health care for the sisters, caring for difficult persons in the community, affirming those who are fearful and depressed, discerning the benefits and burden of treatments, placement of a sister in the infirmary or hospital, and enabling the continued development of the community's psychological, physical, and spiritual wellness as it fulfills its mission are the special responsibilities of leaders in our religious communities. Needed resources to assure the continued vitality of the mission of the community in the church while providing an appropriate level of care, spiritual, human, financial, and environmental as well, tests the strength of the community's bonds and especially our faith in loving Father who was only good for his children. Our superiors are indeed no strangers to the challenges inherent in the ministry of leadership. As we continue to enable the growth of our communities in all their human and spiritual dimensions, remember the needs of the superiors for quiet time, for prayer, for leisure, for rest, and for some humor too. Our superiors also need understanding, affirmation, trust, and encouragement for the difficult roles we have called them to fulfill on behalf of the community and the church. We must never fail to support those we have called to a ministry of leadership. We expect our superiors to preach to us and, of course, listen to us. This listening is our first preaching encounter. Superiors also need to listen to the preaching moments we offer to them, since it is through the expression of the religious vocation of the entire community that the community's mission is authentically fulfilled. This leads us then to the journey of hope. Caring for the sick and the dying in our religious communities is our first preaching. It is the prophetic witness and authenticating sign of what we communicate by word of mouth. We are then the living witnesses and the architects of the plan for unity, which is the crowning point of human history and God's design, as noted in Vita Consecrata. This is our first preaching moment. This is our caring moment. When these two profound events occur in an authentic way, healing and hope are bound together in a truly holy encounter. To fulfill our mission of caring, we must call one another to the generous and courageous acceptance of all the demands which community life makes of us, caring for our sisters and brothers who are suffering in any way, physically, psychologically, socially, and spiritually, and especially the alienated and the marginalized among us. Affirmation and reverence of our elderly sisters and brothers, compassionate care for those suffering with chronic diseases and intractable pain, the terminally ill and the dying, good stewardship of our personal health, and accountability for use of the community's resources. Preaching and caring with compassion is the healing ministry of Jesus Christ. As vowed religious, preaching and caring with compassion must be our ministry to one another and to all we serve. As members of the Christian community, we as healers have the power to embrace and overcome any obstacles to fulfillment of this noble promise. Joseph Cardinal Bernardin, in his pastoral letter on health care, a sign of hope, wrote, "As Christians, we are called, indeed empowered, to comfort others in the midst of their suffering by giving them reason to hope. We are called to help them experience God's enduring love for them. This is what makes Christian healthcare truly distinctive. We are to do for one another what Jesus did, comfort others by inspiring in them hope and confidence in life, as God's ongoing creative activity in the world and the love of Christ make it possible for us to continue to live despite the chaos of illness. So too our work in the world must also give hope to those whom we care. Our distinctive vocation in Christian healthcare is not so much to heal better or efficiently than anyone else. It is to bring comfort to people by giving them an experience that will strengthen their confidence in life. The ultimate good of our care is to give to those who are ill through our care a reason to hope. The care of the sick and the dying, entering the heart of Jesus' special ministry, the highest form of the imitatio Dei, when viewed in partnership with Jesus, the author of all life, is a very special aspect of the stewardship of creation, because it cares for the summit of creation, human beings, nurturing the life that is in them, easing the pain that diminishes them, and accompanying them in their ultimate journey. This is one of the many pastoral roles each of you have chosen to exercise, the role that each of you have been called by name before time began. So may God protect you, protect each of us in this every caring moment as we embrace the sick and fulfill our promise to preach God's love, to care for the sick with compassion, and to bring hope and healing to those we love and those whom we have promised to care. Now I'd like to distribute a guide we talked about, and I'll give us a few minutes to read that, and then we can have a great conversation. We reviewed some of the general principles that govern our response to ethical dilemmas that confront us. But as I mentioned earlier, that the landscape is changing almost by the hour. You're aware of the threat to the exercise of freedom of conscience with the HSS rule. You're probably very much involved in that. You're also, those of you who are involved either providing health care to others or to your own community, the difficulty you have sometime getting physicians and others who will support your cares and your mission about what is appropriate for this particular patient. So the culture of death around Catholic healthcare is an ominous threat to the Catholic moral tradition. But I believe that one of the ways that we can respond to that is through the collective wisdom and working together, but more properly to the issues that affect you as superiors or in your communities. I've developed this guide. Actually, it was crafted initially out of Georgetown University Center for Bioethics, and I've used it with physicians as well as medical students to help frame how we get a handle around some of these complex questions. So it minimizes your vulnerability. When a person in your community becomes ill, that person is essentially fractured, and the wholeness comes apart, particularly if it's a devastating diagnosis. If, in fact, you happen to be the healthcare proxy or the major superior, if that's happened to be your role, you're torn between what I should do, and one of the principles that is important to understand here is we can do a lot of things in medicine and healthcare. The question is, ought we to do them? That's the ethical question. Ought we to do these kinds of issues, treatments? So I prepared this guide, and really it starts to be real and applied down in number 3, Roman, the method. So in your role as helping others make decisions, either patients or some members of your community, it's important. One of the most difficult areas in doing ethics consults is getting the facts, getting them clear. And the consults I've been involved in, that it consumes most of the time. Really, what are the issues? What's the diagnosis? What's the prognosis? What are the options? What are the chronology events? What's the biography of the patient? Now, this may look to be more appropriate for clinicians, but it really isn't. It's designed to be applied for and used by anyone who is faced about decisions about how to advance or guide people to make informed decisions according to Catholic moral tradition. And then it goes down to what are the issues? Are the issues actually ethical in nature, or are they communication issues? Are there problems of communication, as you mentioned? Are there clinical issues narrowly defined, or problems of diagnosis and therapy? And I'm sure that most of you, if not all of you, can give an example of issues and questions that's come to you that you had to look at these questions. And then how should the issue be framed? And this, I think, is really critical here, is we obviously want to look at the biomedical good of the patient, but we have to look at the broader goals and in terms of the goods and of other parties. So the order of making decisions is what's good for this particular patient. In a religious community, it takes a little bit different direction than it would be in a family, for example, because we are vowed to a charism and to a congregation. The decisions of the individual sister are not completely unattached or unconnected to the mission cares in the community. So it has to be taken into consideration. And the ultimate good, what is the ultimate good that we're trying to look at? And then it breaks them out specifically, the good of the patient, the good of interest of other parties, how do they stand vis-a-vis other issues, and the prudential questions. What should be done for this patient before you, presented to you in the sister in your infirmary, a brother in the retirement community? How are you going to possibly sort all these issues and keep at bay all the negative variables that influence your, can influence your decision if you're not comfortable or confident about how to proceed? Sometimes the environments and where we place our religious members of the community in either in hospitals or in other care facilities are hostile to our tradition. So then you have to make a judgment. Is that the appropriate place? Should we move her, move him? So I could be happy now to answer any of your questions that you wish to put forth. I know that's a lot, but you probably have a burning ethical dilemma. Yes, sister. Well, one question I always ask you to get the facts: at what point in the patient's illness did he or she make the decision? No mechanical feeding. If it was done before they begin to lose competence, that's one question. If it's after, then it's probably invalid, probably because that has to be looked at. Some facilities are saying, upon admission, this facility believes in these principles, and this is what we're going to do. So it really, in a sense, takes away it doesn't take away completely the freedom to decide about treatment, but they also have the option not to come into your facility. We believe in providing nutrition hydration. That's different than providing nutrition hydration mechanically. That's a different question. People get them confused. I remember working with a sister some years ago, and she was admitted to the emergency room, and she was quite alert, elderly. And the nurse who admitted her said, "Do you want nutrition hydration?" Now, the nurse was thinking in terms of mechanical means, but the sister said, "Aren't you going to feed me?" So here is this huge conflict between the use of these terms. And it finally processed that she wanted to be fed the normal route as well as through mechanical means in the hospital setting. But I would go back to the patient. What's the anxiety about why, assuming the patient is competent now? If the patient isn't competent, who is the healthcare surrogate? And can you help us inform us about how that decision was made? Even though the patient says that they don't want this, and it's clearly against the Catholic moral tradition, you're not obligated to do what the patient wants. You're clearly not obligated, because you have the right of conscience and your autonomy as well. And no patient or doctor can ever trump on that. So it could be in a situation where you're going to have to say, no, this patient cannot be admitted here, or I have to recuse myself. I happen to be the doctor or the nurse. The family wants a particular intervention. You have to be willing to say, no, that's not appropriate. I remember one consult that I was involved in. The woman was in her 80s, and she had a subdural hematoma, a bleed in the brain. They brought her into the hospital, and the daughter and son said, no treatment, not to be treated, other than comfortable. And the doctor was a neurosurgeon. He called, and he was very anxious. This is the first time he'd ever had this type of a conflict with the patient's family, because the patient wasn't competent. He said, "I can't. First of all, it's not good medical practice. We should treat this person. And secondly, it's against my belief system." I said, "And then what do you think you should do?" He said, "Well, I don't want to abandon the patient, but I can't respond to their requests." So he said, "How about calling a consult, ethics consult?" So we brought the family in, the doctor, social worker, all those people who were involved in the caring for the patient. And the neurosurgeon explained to the family why he felt she should be treated, the patient. So they acquiesced to his request, and she was treated, and she went home in a week. All of a sudden, now that this lady was not to be treated according to the directives of the daughter and son. But sometimes you're not always that easy. But it doesn't happen as smooth as that. But there are times when you simply have to say, no, that's not appropriate for this facility. It's clearly against our principles. And if you understand on admission that perhaps you should consider another facility. My sense is to help them understand, why did you choose X facility to begin with? Why do you want to come here? And so in every account like this, we have a moment of evangelization to try to convince them. Sometimes it's given, these limitations of treatment are given because people are afraid they're going to be extended forever. And they need to understand that the church has never said that. The church says you're not. It's morally obligate, optional, if you wish to continue treatment that is either effective or ineffective or burdensome. You may continue it, but you may withdraw it. But you have the family who fears dependency on mechanical devices, and then you have the physicians who are afraid of legal recourse of the patient. So they need to be evangelized too. So that's a long answer, but. I had Franciscan who taught me ethics. He said, when you have one ethics case, you have one. The tradition stands, but what makes it unique is the person in front of you. Sister. Sure. Yes, the church does reflect that in the ERDs. The first encounter about the benefit and burden phenomenon has to reside with the patient, not the healthcare administrator, not the insurance company, or not the family. The first encounter is with the patient. Once that's resolved, then you have to consider how this treatment may affect the financial questions around the family. So that has to be considered. And then the larger good, for example, are we putting in enormous amount of resources into caring for a patient whose treatment is in the extremes of possibility of reversing the natural course of the disease, when those resources could be used more properly for other people? For example, in some of our teaching hospitals where there's research going on, the researchers are looking for subjects, and they have this research protocol, but the possibility of reversing that disease is 1 in 10,000. The church doesn't say we have to test that. We have to be reasonable. That's the beauty about the tradition. Have to be what's reasonably possible in reversing the natural course of this disease. But sometimes it does spill over to the family when the burden is so great. But it's always the patient first. And then you move to the family, and then to the community. The whole debate continues about whether or not children should be vaccinated. You know, while this is not an end of life question, but if my child is not vaccinated against smallpox and measles, do I expose the children in the school to the possibility of this potentially lethal disease, or do I expose my own child to another person? So you see that the dilemma here. The issue is grounded largely in the development of the vaccines from aborted stem cells. And it gets into the question of formal and material cooperation. Is the fact that aborted stem cells were used to create the vaccines 60 years ago really a form of formal cooperation now? Or is it material? Well, it's somewhere in the area of material. I think the ethicists would agree to that. But then you have to look at the community good around that particular question. But and there are some families, again, looking at the community, family that who have the authority to make a decision on behalf of the patient and want everything done, even though there's very, very little possibility that these interventions will reverse the natural course of the disease. And that's a tough one. Because it creates conflict among clinicians. Some are clearly supportive of the Catholic teaching, and some are afraid of litigation, and then you have this huge conflict. problem is they're talking above the patient, not with the patient. Now you have a difficulty when the patient is not competent. Let me talk a little bit about competency. Competency is highly variable. We don't know a whole lot about how the brain functions. We know a lot about healthcare and the physiology of the body. We only know about 15% of how the brain actually processes information and where it's stored. So this gets to the question, how do you legitimately define a patient who is in a persistent vegetative state when we have evidence that they have come out of these experiences some years later and completely aware of what was going on during it? So were they misdiagnosed? Was it really persistent vegetative state, or was it what they call the lockdown syndrome? So my sense is, in all those cases of doubt, always treat. Always treat. Don't hesitate not to treat. If it's not effective or burdensome, then you have the opportunity either to say, I'm going to proceed, or to withdraw treatment. An example was a young man who was 17 years of age, had a football injury, had another trauma to the brain. His mother didn't want anything extraordinary done. This person was perfectly healthy. The father said, we have to treat. There was a conflict between the mother and the father. The ethicist on call said, my position is, we have to treat. Again, this was a minor, therefore the parents had the authority to make the decision. Well, through lots of persuasion and conversation, we finally convinced the mother that let's try this treatment. So he went home in about 3 weeks. Yet she said, no treatment. He would have certainly died. The father said treatment. So you see, they have this conflict. But let me talk a little bit about determination of competency. You can admit an elderly person or someone who's had an injury, and you may have a diagnosis where this person is not competent to make decisions, has lost decisional capacity. That's very, in my mind, very suspicious. Because you've had experiences in your own life, in your own communities, where today's sister is very bright. She knows where she is, who she is, what time of the day it is, yet in another 2 hours, he or she is confused. It's the moment of reality that you ask the questions. So you may have to try several times to get him or her at the right time to understand what's the treatment protocol in the language they understand. Ask him to repeat, sister, do you understand what we're saying here? But in that state of awareness, they can make their own decisions. But how often we say, too old, has a fractured hip, they need a knee replacement, she's had a stroke, therefore we're not going to treat with antibiotics or intravenous fluids. So you see how it becomes, and if you are the decision maker, you're also vulnerable in that whole process. So you're confused and conflicted about what you should do. You have your own values that come to us from your congregation as well as the Catholic moral tradition, but you have this pressure from the system to say, she's not going to make it, I want to withdraw treatment. And you have to be very firm in those kinds of decisions. But as I mentioned earlier, please don't try not to feel that you're totally alone in those kinds of decisions. There's very, very few decisions in healthcare that decisions must be made within minutes. Very few decisions. They can usually be deferred. I've helped many religious go through issues around their own brothers and sisters because they don't know the questions to ask. And so that's where the ethics can really be a help. I'm always willing to talk to the clinician, and I can ask the impertinent questions. But you have to get the facts. That's the key in this whole, in the full whole Roman 3a. What are the facts? It takes a long time to get the facts. That's any other questions that come to mind? Yes, sister. You ask a question, does she have the right to make that authority? Yes, she has the authority to make the decision, but the question is it an informed decision? And that's where you have to work with your patients long to see why is it a burden to discuss with them exactly what is their concern. There are some people who, and you've had your experience as well, who have gone through excessive, not excessive, but extensive treatment, and they say, this is not working. I'm tired of it, and I'm not getting better. There's where the burden-benefit equation is there. I want to be kept comfortable, but you're not obligated to ever use treatment that is not beneficial or is burdensome. Or if you have started it, you have the moral option either to continue it or to withdraw it without difficulty. But the guilt is profound, particularly with the decision makers. If I decide, and I have all the proper evidence that we should withdraw mechanical nutrition, am I starving the patient? I remember working with a woman some years ago, and she brought the question up, and it was so real to her that she was certain that she killed her brother because the doctor said, we cannot reverse the natural course of this disease, and to continue to feed him mechanically through a PEG tube is burdensome. So she says, I agreed with that, but I have a real concern based on the papal allocution in 2004 that we should continue to provide nutrition hydration. But the problem is people who didn't read the document to its completion missed one of the final points. Until it reaches its natural end, that is where it's no more effective, you're not obligated to continue it. So back to your question, Sister, I would work with them to see if they are, and that's a challenge to dealing with people who have any cognitive impairment. Do they understand the decision that they're asking you to affect? Do they clearly understand you may have to repeat it over and over and over again? You may not agree with their decision, but if you think it's informed, if it doesn't conflict with your facility's principles or your own principles, it may be that you'll have to move the patient to another facility because we really can't support that particular request. I remember one situation where a woman was brought into the nursing home. She had advanced pneumonia and had been in a PVS state, as they said, for a number of years. And the daughter told the resident that she wanted him to give her mother a bolus of morphine. A bolus of morphine is a large dose that really terminates life immediately. And he said, I cannot do that because that's really what would be murder. And your mother is not dying. She may be very sick, but she wasn't dying. So she was obviously knowledgeable about healthcare, so she insisted on calling an ethics consult, which we had with her. So we tried to understand why she was wanting this intervention. And she said, I want this over. I want my mother to end her life, and because I'm having a Christmas party in a few days, and if she's going to have a funeral. This is a Catholic hospital, but I don't believe that she or the daughter, the patient or the daughter were Catholic, but that doesn't make a difference. The principal stood. So the ethicist was very good. He said to her, that would not be appropriate. That would be murder, and we will not do that here, and you'll not have it done in any hospital in this area. So I said, you understand what you're asking? You're asking us to terminate your mother's life? She said, well, she's so uncomfortable. And she's writhing in the bed. She's confused. He said, we can give her very small doses of morphine to relax her. So we did. And that worked out fine. But the thinking of some people, as a matter of convenience, you know, people are disposable. I was telling one of the sisters earlier, with this healthcare system, more and more people are not being brought into the system. They're being taken out of the system. So it gets down to the question, the fundamental ethical question, who do we really care about? Who really matters in healthcare? So, yeah, we're all at risk. We're all at risk. So, sister.
I'm not a nurse. I haven't really worked in healthcare, but
the clinicians in the audience will know this exactly. But you know that the biology of cancer is a virus. It takes everything to itself first, away from the host. to survive. That's just the nature of a virus. This is another real case. The gentleman had an advanced brain cancer. He was not treatable. He had gone through chemotherapy and all the conventional treatments, but it was out of control. He decided that he wanted to continue to be fed mechanically. So they put in a PEG tube, because they don't like to put in the nasogastric tube because it ulcerates the nasal mucosa. They put in the PEG tube, and he managed that for a few weeks. Then he began to get these massive headaches that were not resolved by medication. So what's happening here is that in the brain, and there's no valves in the brain, it's a closed cavity, the cancer was rapidly growing because the nutrition going into the PEG tube was growing the brain tumor. So you see, what is the benefit of this? This treatment is not reversing the natural course of the disease, therefore it's appropriate to discontinue the PEG tube. He could take nutrition by mouth, a little bit. So the question of nutrition and hydration is not always mechanical. It can be or orally, either through water or Jell-O or broth or anything liquid. They even sips understands and protects the principle of human dignity, that we're trying to provide nutrition and hydration as best we can, even though the mechanical mechanisms are not working. Many of you are in healthcare and know what happens when a patient dies from dehydration. That's not a pleasant sight, at least in the initial stages of it. After a while, they become somnolent and relaxed. But the intention here is to always continue to hydrate, even though you have to give it in the cheek, and they can assuming they can swallow. If they can't, if they lost their swallowing capacity, that's one thing. But the principle of feeding even that way is protected under it's actually number 58 of the ERDs. And there was a lot of discussion about that in the last few years, because the ERDs was not clear, or need to be clear, because there was this large reaction. Negative reaction to the papal allocution 2004, and it created a lot of conflict about should every patient be fed mechanically in every circumstance. The church never said that, nor did the papal allocution say that. So it was the understanding. What it reaffirmed the longstanding teaching of the church in that regard. So. So that would be one example. I'm trying to think of another one. Oh, another example is where the patient's not able to take anything by mouth, and you have to feed at their request through the PEG tube. It gets to a point in advanced cancer, particularly the abdominal area, where what you put in the PEG tube comes out through the rectum in the same form, which says the body is not assimilating the nutrition to it. Nothing's happening. It's not improving, and you can understand that, because you're putting in the nutrition in the PEG tube, but they're losing weight, becoming more cachetic and more thin. So you see, it's not appropriate. They have lost the ability to assimilate that nutrient to the muscle and the body tissue, which emphasizes the principle in the allocution until it reaches its natural end, when it's no longer effective. Same way with the medications. I believe you should always treat, as I said before, if in doubt, treat. There are some experimental medications that should not be used because of their catastrophic effect upon the system. For example, most of the medications we give today are metabolized in the liver, but the liver is full of disease. Why are you putting that medication into that patient when you can use more conservative ways to relieve pain? And those kinds of interventions, as opposed to using experimental drugs. But see, you're in a situation today, and many of us are in a situation where we send our members to teaching facilities, and they want to do research. So advocating not only for the care, but also advocating for the research protocols. And if in fact the sister or brother is alert, and the doctors determine that, they don't have to ask you the surrogate decision maker, because the person makes their own decisions. So you see, you not only need to protect them when they're not competent, but if they're in and out in the times that they are competent. So they need a guardian, which is another challenge, responsibility for you as superiors. Some of you probably have advanced directives that says the major superior is the first decision maker, and that person has certainly has the grace of office and the knowledge of oftentimes the knowledge of the life of the sister. But I'm suggesting, as you review them, that you put the name of the major superior in the document, not just transferable from office to office, because we've had a situation in our province a couple of times only where the prior provincial is the principal decision maker, but he could not make a decision about a particular brother because he was that brother's novice. So you see the variables of that fact. Now we actually have a document that has the principal decision proxy decision maker and an alternate, and in some cases we have a third person. If the first, they don't have to act together, but you have to understand that sometimes I can't really share some of my beliefs with you because of who you are, and so they have to have the freedom. But by and large, most of the members of religious communities will accept the major superior. Not all, but most. So, but that's a decision that can be very lonely, because you don't have to consult. You may consult. I encourage you to consult. But remember, when you make those decisions, they're on behalf of what the sister told you, how she wanted to be treated. And the more general that you can make them and applying the principles, the more helpful it is, as opposed to a living will, which I do not recommend, because it doesn't need a proxy decision maker, and you don't want to have a checklist, because as you read the paper, as you have access to get it, it's important that while the principles are there, this is not a rule-based phenomenon. This is not a checklist of things, yes, no, 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 yes. This requires, the Catholic moral tradition requires that we face these questions from the character, the virtue-based approach, rather than a utilitarian. So what's in the heart of the person? Remember, you've all professed to one community or another. So those values really drive the decisions that you make as a proxy, but also drive the decisions that I make as an individual member about how I want to be cared for. It's not 1,500 people in a congregation, all as independent contractors. There's this bond that keeps you together. So you're now all ethicists, isn't that great? But please, if you have a good consultant, that's fine. I'd be happy to help in any way that I can. But it's important I think it's always helpful to relook at your instruments of decision-making on your birth date or profession date. They can change, they may not change. But medical care and treatment changes rapidly. So what you say, I do not want today, and it may be appropriate, may be ameliorated in a couple months. I remember some years ago where a sister said she did not ever want to be put on mechanical ventilation. Well, she was thinking she didn't want to be dependent on the respirator. So she went into the hospital for an appendectomy, and the surgeon saw that. She was under anesthesia at the time. He saw that on the form, and he said, "We can't proceed with the surgery because she'll be on mechanical ventilation for an hour or two after her surgery." So they had to bring her out of the anesthesia and clarify, "Sister, what did you mean?" "Well, I didn't mean that." Well, you see, so it's important that you be aware of what you say you want done or do not want done. But anyway, she got the appendix out and she went home. We could go on for several days, but each of you have your own graces and how you will approach the threats on human dignity in healthcare in the United States today. And I think the power in this area of evangelization is the group, not individuals. I mean, you can do a lot, but you can do a lot more to influence systems, legislators, physicians. This is what we stand for. You know, people are looking for that security to know if you think you're vulnerable making decisions, the larger world is hungry for help. And so it's appropriate with the gospel that are trying to extend the healing ministry of Jesus to the whole world. And we're global people, so yes, sister. Well, in the case, that's a very good question. What I've done in that is to work with people who know the sister to help me understand how she would have made decisions about anything relative to health care when she was young. Well, if she presents into the emergency room and there's no documentation, if you go to a hospital where they know your community, they will typically respond favorably to the religious superior. However, if you go to a hospital where they don't even know you, everything will be done. Everything will be done because they have to practice according to standards of practice. So that's the problem. Sister, do you have Lucille? Do you have a No, okay. That's a challenge in the neurological illnesses, because if there's a stroke, either because of the fracture of the circulatory system or there's a frank bleed, it takes time that the body responds by bringing massive amounts of fluid to the brain, therefore it swells, and therefore you can have periods of unconsciousness and confusion and inappropriate behavior. But that'll clear in time. You have to give people opportunities for that to clear out. Sometimes it takes a few days, sometimes it takes a few months, depending on their circulatory status. But the good thing you bring up, the question of terminal, because that's a very gelatinous term. There are people who are terminal, people who have diagnosed with inoperable cancer are terminal, but they may live for 3 years. The question is really, is this person imminently dying? In other words, is his death about to happen in a few hours or a few days? That's different than terminal. But so it's to be familiar and challenging. And the sister Christine's got a good question. What we did in our Center for Assisted Living in Washington, we were concerned about what we thought was a clinical care not appropriate and border on the unethical. So we had a conversation with a group practice. So all of our friars went to this one group practice. They had maybe 15 different specialists. So anything you possibly need was in that group practice. But they clearly knew, we will contract with this group practice if you agree to care for our brothers with these principles. No problem. Because they were assured of 35 patients. So it wasn't certainly a financial, but even if you have individual one physician caring for a group of your members of the congregation, I think the question is fair. We want to know, what is your position on these questions? Sister? One way you might suggest is having an extended conversation with her and keep trying to... Sometimes the experience of the past drive the current decisions, and they're either not aware of how much those early decisions are affecting their current behavior, maybe it's too painful. So reaching out to them in a pastoral way can try to convince them that, or help them understand that God is the author of life. We're just the stewards of it. And you want her to have peace. He's at peace, you see. She's at peace, but she isn't. This is one thing that I know you've found on all of your infirmaries and care for the sick, that you have sisters who are approaching the atrium Chailey, and they've had a profound illness that's not treatable. They've had extensive surgeries and all sorts of interventions, but it really doesn't matter to them. They set that aside, and that's really the authentic measure of what Jesus talks about moving people along the journey of hope. You're not letting the disease define you. It's your belief in the loving Father that's really defining you. And, you know, every one of your communities, infirmaries, have those prophets. Some are more obvious than others, but it's really, I've only probably seen five in my experience, but it's really transformative. as people become profoundly ill, not only is the patient vulnerable, but so is the clinician. Example, I was working with a young resident. She had admitted this patient to the emergency room some years ago as a medical student. She had bilateral breast disease, cancer in both. She was in another consult. She said, I have to go in and tell my patient that we can't do any more for her. I said, wait a minute now. Let's have a conversation. Come into my office. They went around the corner. I said, let's do a little role play. I'm the doctor and you're the patient. I'm going to tell you we can do nothing more for you. And she said, well, what's your immediate reaction? She said, well, you just abandoned me. I said, yes, that's the point. You're going to go and tell this lady that you've been working with for several years, and you're going to abandon her? And she stopped and says, what am I going to say? I said, you go in the room. This is an intensive care unit, and they each was in their own room. I stood outside, and she went in, and she said to the patient, I don't have good news for you. Doctor said to the nurse. And then the doctor said to the patient. The patient said to the nurse, will you accompany me in the journey? And she said, yes. That was all that needed to be said, you see. So at that point then, who was the healer? So in this encounter between those who are called for healing and those who promise to give it, it's this very unique relationship that can't be measured, can't be put on an algorithm, but that's what we do when we care, when we shepherd people towards this, the ultimate union with Christ. It's a very special act of creation, and it is our one of our former masters of the order said, caring for one another is our first preaching. Is our very first preaching. If we can do it to one another, we can do it to the larger world. Sister?
Yeah, I want you to think of the old score of the physician order of life sustaining treatment versus the durable power of attorney. We have that in the state of California right now.
Yeah, my sense is the durable power of attorney is, if it's crafted properly, is built off the Catholic moral tradition and allows the decisions to be enunciated, or the values enunciated by the patient, rather than a very specific. It's moving more towards the checklist phenomenon. There's a number of states who have the pulse instrument, but I feel that you have to look at the question from your own belief system and let those words come forward in the conversation with the person who's going to make those decisions. And that's beautifully done in the community where it can really happen. So. The form that we use in our province, as well as the NCBC form, is strikes about the question of the moral principles as the driving force. That I'll do nothing, for example, in the practice of making decisions for another person that are in contrary to the Catholic moral tradition. That's pretty broad, but that's the point of it. You see, we don't want to get to a checklist. We don't want to reduce the process to a mathematics. Don't sign any form. No, I would resist that in a definitive way. That of course is an example of the violation of your right of conscience. I don't know what the California Catholic Conference says about that, but the option you have on this particular sister is not take her to the hospital. It's to bring care to her. Good for you. Oh, that's all right. You can medicate it as unhappiness. We can take care of that.
But I'm the one who has the girl with power. It's like, no, you're not taking it to the emergency.
Good. This is an area whether or not, like I mentioned earlier, about the making sure the physicians support your principles, whether or not you can find a physician who will come into the facility. because you know, if the sister is not doesn't have a strong advocate, even if she has a dural power of attorney, doctors are not obligated under law to obey that. That's another problem. It's not a legal document. So the key is to take charge of the situation. Yes. I my suggestion is take that to the California Catholic Conference and see what options you have to avoid that. You're talking about a diagnosis of clinical depression or?
No, just that somebody, because they are
okay.
Often
happens more in community probably than we realize. If people are not necessarily be able to articulate it so clearly, they want to be burdened to the superior, they don't want to be using resources because of the cost. This is where the whole theology about health care and healing is important to the whole community, not just to the group that needs the elderly. So what is your philosophy about human dignity across the whole community, that who you are and when you made profession to this community, we commit our life and our work and our resources to help you move towards perfection. And you're not, so you have to unpack the care of the burden. I mean, the phenomenon of the burden. Why do they? And it's common, more common than we probably realize that just don't do anything extraordinary. What does that mean? You see. Because it depends on the condition, and they get this terms confused between ordinary and extraordinary. There's no list of ordinary, extraordinary terms. It's all related to how it affects the individual person. So what may be ordinary for me may be clearly extraordinary for you, but we're not obligated to do the extraordinary, however that might mean. The church has never advocated that. In fact, it's very clear in the teachings of Paul, Pius XII. We defined this. Actually, the person who defined that back in the 15th century was a Dominican friar who defined ordinary and extraordinary means. Francisco de Vitoria. So we take credit for that. Well, it's been great to be with you. And please pick up my card. And any of you, those who would like the full document, just send me an email. I'll be happy to mail it to you electronically. And blessings on the rest of your workshop.
This little card is going to be very valuable, I bet. Brother is, thank you so much, brother. He is incredibly, almost nobody would give you their card to this many people. But he is very, very generous and responds. You would think he wasn't doing anything because whenever you ask something, I don't know how you do it. But anyway, he works very quickly and apparently because he gets back to you immediately and it's right on. It's you know that it's the right thing to do. So brother, we are grateful and don't forget the cards. That email address might be of benefit at some point. God bless you, sisters. Thank you.